This is 88.7 FM WBFO in Buffalo. Good morning. I'm Jim Ranney reporting live from the Robert H. Jackson Center in Jamestown, where a crowd of about 2,000 has gathered this morning on the front lawn of the center in Jamestown to hear an address from Chief Justice John Roberts. In addition to local dignitaries, which include Congressman Brian Higgins and federal, state, and local judges, there are hundreds of students here this morning. Students from 24 schools in Western New York arrived by school bus this morning to take part in a history lesson of sorts, a live history lesson. It is a rare occasion for a Chief Justice to make such an appearance, but this is a homecoming of sorts for Justice Roberts. He was born in Buffalo back in 1955. He lived in the area until he was in the fourth grade. His father was a plant manager at Bethlehem Steel. Justice Roberts is here to mark the 10th anniversary of the formal dedication of the Jackson Center, named for the late Chief Justice Robert Jackson, who served on the High Court until 1954. Robert Jackson grew up in Chautauqua County and rose to the Supreme Court, and again served until 1954. He was also the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. This center, the Jackson Center, has been established to carry out his legacy and is dedicated to mission of Justice Jackson. The dedication, which took place back in 2003, for that dedication, William Rehnquist was here. He was then Chief Justice of the court, and he was here back in 2003 to formally dedicate this center, and now it's Chief Justice Roberts here today to mark the 10th anniversary of this facility. Ceremony's just getting underway here this morning, and we expect now to hear the national anthem performed. Among those in attendance, the choir from the Jamestown High School, and they will perform our national anthem this morning.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming. And the rockets regular, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner the land of the free and the home of the brave.
The national anthem actually performed by Juanita Wallace Jackson this morning along with the concert stage and Jamestown Choral Society. We now expect to hear from Professor John Barrett from St. John's University School of Law to introduce the Chief Justice.
Before I introduce Professor John Barrett, who will introduce the Chief Justice of the United States, I would like to acknowledge everyone here who has made this special Robert H. Jackson Center extraordinary, including this amazing community. It goes without saying that all of you, in many forms or fashion, have made sure that this special event, whether they're docents, individuals, participants, people who've supported us, it's an incredible moment in time. I would like to recognize Justice Robert H. Jackson's grandchildren, Tom Loftus, Melissa Jackson, and great-grandson, Quentin Morgan. Also, we're privileged today to have two of former law clerks to Justice Robert Jackson with us. Phil Neal, who was his law clerk in the 1943-44 term. Phil and E. Barrett Prettyman, Jr., right here, who was his law clerk during the 1953 and 54 term, and we welcome them to the Robert Jackson Center. Since its earliest meetings in 2001 through today, the Robert H. Jackson Center board, volunteers, and this community have kept true to the word of our mission to advance the legacy of Justice Jackson through education and events emphasizing the current relevance of Jackson's ideas on individual freedoms and justice. From our early days, we have been taught by the surviving Nuremberg prosecutors who joined Justice Jackson in that new frontier known as the Nuremberg trial, resulting in the prosecution of individuals for crimes against humanity there. We annually reconfirm its relevance through the International Humanitarian Law Dialogues, where all the current prosecutors from all the current tribunals join us in August. We've been educated over these past years on the relevance of Justice Jackson through the presence of Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Eugene Gerhardt, Henry Abraham, Bud Schulberg, Bennett Bosky, and William Coleman. We've learned so much from the various hosted symposiums with law clerks for Justice Jackson, including mentioned Phil Neal, Murray Gardner, Jim Marsh, George Kneebank, E. Barrett Prettyman Jr., Donald Cronson, as well as fellow judicial clerks Earl Pollack, Daniel Meter, Gordon Davidson, Abner Mikva, James Paul, Neil Rutledge, Charles Heilman, Marshall Small, pausing to analyze and discuss such monumental cases at the Supreme Court concerning, including West Virginia versus Barnett, Korematsu versus the United States, Youngstown Steel Seizure, and Brown versus Board of Education, among others, all pausing to reflect on history and its relevance in today's world. We've also been educated on that specific relevance of the rule of law from such historical figures as Linda Brown, John Doerr, the Barnett sisters, Lillian Gobitis, Fred Korematsu, James Meredith, Nicholas Katzenbach, Dorothy Cotton, and such current practitioners as Kenneth Starr, Seth Waxman, Jeffrey Stone, Paul Clement, Linda Greenhouse, Dahlia Lithwicks, Pam Carlin, Jeff Schessel, Jeff Toobin, and Harold Burson, among others. We've been thrilled to have those individuals, among others, who've come here to the Robert Jackson Center to tip their hat to Justice Jackson and his work, and also to share their collective wisdoms. But above all, we continue to learn about Justice Jackson's relevance today in many other ways, but none more so than through the writings and presentations of our next special speaker, who will honor us by introducing Chief Justice Roberts. Ladies and gentlemen, St. John's Professor of Law and Robert H. Jackson Center, Elizabeth A. Linné Fellow, John Q. Barrett.
And you've been listening to Gregory Peterson. He is the co-founder and board member of the Robert H. Jackson Center, serving as Master of Ceremonies here this morning.
Thank you very much. A backdrop to this event is an ongoing, if friendly, war between the states, or at least between two states. As a boy, Robert H. Jackson moved from the state of his birth to a second state, where he completed grade school and high school and then embarked on life. Our honored guest, John G. Roberts, Jr., did the same thing in his boyhood. In Jackson's case, following his birth and early boyhood on the family farm in Spring Creek Township, Warren County, Pennsylvania, the move was to Frewsburg, New York, and then to Jamestown, Pennsylvania, to New York. In John Roberts' case, following his birth and early boyhood in Buffalo, New York, the move was to Indiana, New York to Indiana. I do not know the state of the New York versus Indiana rivalry to claim John Roberts. It might exist already. I am sure that in time it will. I do know that Pennsylvanians are a bit unhappy about New York State proudly claiming Pennsylvania's Robert H. Jackson, including since last year, in the heart of Buffalo, the majestic new Robert H. Jackson United States Courthouse. Indeed, a federal judge from Pittsburgh suggested to me that you, Mr. Chief Justice, as the son of a Pitt alumnus, a Johnstowner and a Steeler, as in a steel industry man, should be by heredity on Pennsylvania's side of the battle to claim Robert H. Jackson. But here you are, and we are delighted. Welcome, Chief Justice Roberts, to Jamestown, New York. Welcome to the Robert H. Jackson Center. Welcome to what Justice Jackson regarded as his hometown, the source of what he proudly called his Jamestown jurisprudence. And welcome back to your native Western New York State. Many individual life paths converge here today. I will mention six. Robert Jackson, of course, William H. Rehnquist, Phil Neal, John Roberts, of course, Henry J. Friendly, and E. Barrett Prettyman, Jr. They are great lives, lived in specific locations, intersecting and shaping each other's, sharing the dedication to reasoning, history, principles, and the betterment of lives and society that are the law. Robert Jackson came to Jamestown High School in fall 1909. He then stayed, beginning to work in fall 1910 as an apprentice to two Jamestown lawyers. Jackson's first big case started 100 years ago this month with violent events in this community. During May 1913, Jamestown streetcar workers went on strike. To deprive the railway companies of more than labor, some workers resorted to property crimes. They short-circuited high-tension wires, burned out a powerhouse converter, broke signal handles, tried to saw down power poles, and placed wooden wedges in railroad track switches. Many were arrested. Some then retained a leading lawyer to defend them. But soon he was appointed to a state government office and had to leave the cases. His apprentice, Robert Jackson, was 21 years old. The courts had not yet admitted Jackson to practice law. In these sabotage cases, the defendants and Jackson asked the judge to permit him to take over. The district attorney consented very readily, so the judge agreed. During the trial, Jackson raised a legal objection. Contrary to state law, the DA's case was based only on uncorroborated accomplice testimony. The judge agreed and ordered the jury to acquit. Victory for Jackson in a knockout. Success gets noticed. Soon the Street Railway Company and its president were Robert Jackson clients. A few years later, Jackson caught the eye of a young judge from Buffalo. He recommended Jackson to his former law firm. It recruited Jackson to the big city, the nation's 10th largest. During Jackson's 2 years practicing law in Buffalo, the United States entered World War I and instituted a military draft. Jackson, as the sole financial supporter of his wife, his widowed mother, and his minor sister, was eligible for draft exemption. Mary Willard, Jackson's beloved Jamestown High School English teacher, and effectively his second mother, implored him not to fight. She feared for his life and told him that he was destined for greatness. He might become president, she said, or, she predicted, chief justice. That didn't happen, but Jackson did travel other high-altitude paths. He was recruited back from Buffalo to Jamestown and became the city attorney. He then became its leading private lawyer with a truly general practice. As a still young lawyer, Jackson rose to the top ranks of the legal profession nationally. He also rose in public life, especially through his friendship with Franklin D. Roosevelt, as he became governor of New York and then president. On five occasions, President FDR nominated Jackson to high national office, and he was confirmed by the United States Senate. Jackson served in the Treasury Department and then in the Department of Justice. As Solicitor General of the United States, he argued over 40 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and won almost all of them. As Attorney General of the United States, Jackson managed for 18 complex months the legal issues relating to U.S. preparation for possible involvement in World War II. In 1941, Robert Jackson became Justice Jackson. Until his death in 1954, he served on the Supreme Court as the eloquent, practical, independent justice of permanent greatness and influence. Plus, by appointment of President Truman, Justice Jackson served for what turned out to be a full year away from the Supreme Court as the chief architect of the world's first international criminal court, and then as the U.S. chief prosecutor of Nazi war criminals at what became the Nuremberg trial. William H. Rehnquist, life number two, served in World War II, then completed college, earned two master's degrees, and enrolled at Stanford Law School. There, he impressed a young professor, Phil Neal, life number three, who a few years earlier had been Justice Jackson's law clerk. Professor Neal arranged for Jackson to interview Rehnquist, and soon he hired him. Within 2 years of Rehnquist's clerkship, Justice Jackson was gone. It was a life of only 62 years, but in his full living, it was a giant life. And it is a life of major legacies and growing significance. Life number four, John G. Roberts, Jr., began that very winter in Buffalo. Raised there and then in Indiana, Roberts became a top student at Harvard College and then Harvard Law School. He became a New Yorker again, briefly, when he served as a law clerk to Judge Henry Friendly of the U.S. Court of Appeals in New York City, life number five. Judge Friendly was one of history's greats, and by the way, a Jackson-like lawyer's lawyer, then lawyer's judge, and a great Jackson admirer. In 1980, John Roberts became a law clerk at the Supreme Court to then Associate Justice Rehnquist. Roberts served subsequently in the Justice Department, the White House, and in the Solicitor General's office. He became one of his generation's very finest Supreme Court advocates. In private practice at Hogan & Hartson in Washington, he worked closely with another great attorney, E. Barrett Prettyman, Jr., life number six. Decades earlier, Barrett Prettyman served as Justice Jackson's final law clerk. And in the past decade, Mr. Prettyman has been a devoted, essential member of the Jackson Center Board. Justice Rehnquist, of course, did become Chief Justice of the United States. And 10 years ago yesterday, he spoke here with his direct knowledge and memories of Justice Jackson and with palpable emotion, formally dedicating the Robert H. Jackson Center. During that same month, May 2003, John Roberts was confirmed by the Senate to become a judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. 2 years later, he was appointed Chief Justice of the United States. Now, I have no basis to claim that Indiana imparted anything to John Roberts that was specifically Jacksonian. Most every other step on the Chief Justice's greatly accomplished life path, however, Western New York, study of history, study of law, Judge Friendly, Washington, the Supreme Court, Justice Rehnquist, the executive branch, the Office of the Solicitor General, Supreme Court advocacy, private practice, Barrett Prettyman, judicial service, and Supreme Court service is strikingly Jackson-like and Jackson-connected. It thus is for the Robert H. Jackson Center and this region, and for the Jackson Center's work here and globally, particularly apt and very special to host today's guest, the Chief Justice of the United States, John G. Roberts, Jr.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. My only response to the professor's introduction is that it is great to be back home. at such a beautiful setting, on such a glorious day, it would surely be impossible for any speaker to detract from the occasion. Well, do not underestimate me. When a judge speaks in court, he almost always disappoints half of those present. It is only on an occasion such as this, outside court, that he has a fair chance of disappointing everyone. We are here to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the dedication of the Jackson Center. We do so on an especially significant date. 59 years ago today, the Supreme Court handed down its decision in Brown versus Board of Education, which declared that segregating public school students by race violates the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection. Justice Jackson was, of course, a member of the court that handed down that momentous decision and began the process of undoing the court's grave error in the 1896 case of Plessy versus Ferguson. Now, just weeks before Brown was announced, on March 30, 1954, Justice Jackson suffered a serious heart attack. In mid-May, he was still recovering in a Washington hospital. But symbolic of his resolve, he left the hospital on Monday morning, May 17, and journeyed to the court to be present for the announcement of the Brown decision. Tragically, Justice Jackson suffered another heart attack a few months later and passed away on October 9, 1954. But he left behind an inspiring legacy of a public servant and true patriot. This center stands as a magnificent monument to this great justice. It has attracted numerous visitors from our court, as you've heard. Exactly 10 years ago yesterday, Chief Justice William Rehnquist presided over the dedication of the center. Rehnquist was, of course, law clerk to Robert Jackson, and as it has been noted, I had the privilege of being law clerk to William Rehnquist. And when I was practicing law, I also carried the briefcase of Barrett Prettyman, another Jackson clerk, also here today. So I feel a special tie to the Jackson Center through those connections, and I am especially proud to share this anniversary celebration. This center is an appropriate monument to its namesake, who was well known for his learning and eloquence. The center provides a dynamic home for study, dialogue, and discussion here in the heart of Jackson Country. It is easy for those of us who live in Washington to forget that Robert Jackson was shaped by this beautiful rural region. His formative years in Frewsburg and Jamestown, at a time when families and communities relied on the staple virtues of thrift, industry, and self-reliance, were critically important. He became an attorney primarily through apprenticeship and self-study, and he practiced law as a country lawyer in this area for 20 years. Now, when he left for Washington in 1934 to serve in President Franklin Roosevelt's administration, he traveled fast and far through the ranks of government. In the brief span of 8 years, he moved from general counsel of the Bureau of Revenue to assistant attorney general in the Justice Department's antitrust division, to solicitor general, to attorney general, to associate justice of the Supreme Court. But his life was too short. He died at the age of 62 after serving only 13 years on the court. But what a mark he left. By my count, he delivered 154 opinions of the court, 46 concurring opinions, 115 dissents, and another 15 separate opinions concurring in part and dissenting in part. His decisions reflect extraordinary insight and craftsmanship. Many are and will continue to be lodestars of American jurisprudence. The Jackson Center chronicles that extraordinary career, and it serves as a vibrant reminder that the good works of great men endure beyond their own limited years. Because Chief Justice Rehnquist had the special privilege of working with Justice Jackson as a law clerk, his insights into the man are especially pertinent. In a 1980 Law Review article, then Associate Justice Rehnquist identified a core attribute that helped to explain the strength of Jackson's character. As Rehnquist put it, Jackson possessed that rare ability to profit from experience, to to accommodate his views when experience seemed to require accommodation, and yet to maintain throughout his life a sturdy independence of view that took nothing on someone else's say-so. Consequently, as Jackson steadily progressed from successful small-town lawyer to government counsel to attorney general and ultimately to associate justice, he was able to carry along, as Rehnquist put it, a measure of Frewsburg common sense and a recollection that there is indeed life west of the Appalachian Mountains. But what seemed to impress Rehnquist most was that Jackson did not regard his private practice in New York as a route to high office in Washington, nor did he regard his various executive branch positions as a series of stepping stones to the Supreme Court. Rather, as Rehnquist put it, he served each of the interests he was bound to serve faithfully and well during the time which he undertook to serve them. He never used them as means merely to further his career. Now, even as Supreme Court Justice, Jackson answered a further call to government service and took on one of the most challenging assignments of his extraordinary life. He accepted President Truman's assignment to serve as chief counsel for the United States in the prosecution of the Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg. Jackson temporarily took leave of his judicial responsibilities, a matter of some controversy, and returned to the role of lawyer because the president asked him to serve his country in that capacity. He understood the gravity of his assignment. As he put it in his famous opening statement at Nuremberg, "We must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants today is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow. We must summon such detachment and intellectual integrity to our task that this trial will commend itself to posterity as fulfilling humanity's aspirations to do justice." Now, Justice Jackson left us nearly 60 years ago. It is natural to ask, if we were to invite him to the court today, what he would think about how it has evolved over the past six decades. Now, we know that Justice Jackson was never one to waste a moment, and if we invited him, he would be at the court first thing tomorrow morning. Upon his arrival at the court plaza, he would encounter his first shock. The front facade of the building is currently wrapped in a giant scrim, a drape, hiding scaffolding and an ongoing marble restoration project. The building, which was a mere 6 years old when he joined the court, is currently undergoing an exterior renovation to repair the effects of Washington weather on the beautiful Vermont marble. Now, once Jackson recovered from that shock, he would encounter another. The building is closed on Saturdays. This is a sharp departure from the practice during his tenure, when the court was open 6 days a week and the justices always set aside Saturday to discuss cases at their weekly conference. Now, I don't mean to suggest that the justices today don't work on Saturdays, just that the building itself is not open to the public. So if Justice Jackson were to wait until Monday morning to come to the court, he would need to arrive a little bit earlier than usual. The court now convenes for business at 10 a.m. rather than at noon as it had during his tenure. He may also want to allow time for a stop at the court's public cafeteria. We know from his papers that Justice Jackson was fond of the cafeteria manager's specialties. The justices today continue to partake of the same fare that is offered to the public. Unfortunately, the legendary cafeteria manager of Justice Jackson's days, Mrs. Mertens, is gone, and her famous Alabama Pronto pups are off the menu, but we have now panini sandwiches and frozen yogurt at steeply higher prices that would certainly have offended Justice Jackson's thrifty Western New York sensibilities. Now, when Jackson proceeds upstairs to his chambers, he is in for another shock. His office, which was located on the northeast side of the building, is now occupied by one of Justice Thomas's law clerks. During the 1950s, when the justices typically had just one law clerk, the justices' chambers were located in the back of the building. Now, over time, the number of law clerks expanded to four. And in 1972, the court renovated and expanded the existing chambers to provide more space. It correspondingly added new chambers to the front of the building, where Justices Kennedy, Breyer, and Kagan now reside. The views of the Capitol from those chambers are absolutely spectacular, except not right now. If you've been paying attention, you'll recall that those views are now blocked by scaffolding and a scrim. Now, with all of these surprises, Justice Jackson might be ready to seek quiet refuge in the court's library. He would find that the library's beautiful reading room looks remarkably familiar, except for one significant matter. There are no people there, other than the dedicated library staff. Most of the law clerks do their research now from computer terminals in their offices. Now, of course, the justice would need a little briefing on what computer terminals are as well. At 9:55 in the morning, Justice Jackson would hear the familiar buzzer indicating that the court will convene shortly and it's time to proceed to the robing room. From there, it's a short walk across the hall to the courtroom. That has changed little in appearance since 1954. The drapes and the carpet are still a deep burgundy. But Justice Jackson would notice a significant difference in the shape of the mahogany bench behind which the nine justices sit. In Jackson's era, the bench was straight from end to end. But now the end segments join the center at slight angles, creating a curved bench. Chief Justice Warren Burger implemented this change in 1972 to enable the justices to see one another during argument. It also has the effect of partially surrounding arguing counsel, just in case they were not intimidated enough already. Justice Jackson would also note that the four small desks, which were previously in the well of the court in front of the bench, were gone. In Justice Jackson's time, when decisions were announced, they were literally handed down to court reporters sitting at those desks. Those reporters would then roll up the opinions and place them in bullet-shaped cylinders, insert the cylinders into pneumatic tubes, which would convey the opinions downstairs to the wire service reporters. Those reporters would then use that hard copy to write their stories. Now, when the court announces its decision, it simply posts them simultaneously on the court's website. When the court strikes 10 a.m., the court takes the bench. When the clock strikes 10 a.m., the court takes the bench, just as punctually as in Jackson's day. But the composition of the court is strikingly different. In Jackson's day, the court consisted of nine men. The nine came from different parts of the country. It was still customary for the president to strive for regional diversity when nominating justices. But remarkably, at that time, only one of the justices, Sherman Minton, had significant experience as a judge prior to joining the court. By contrast, the current court includes three women, and eight of the nine members were judges before becoming Supreme Court justices. That's a change in the background of the justices that many have suggested has altered how the justices view their work. Now, being a Monday, Justice Jackson would expect to hear the announcement of opinions, because in his day, opinions were announced only on Mondays. But Chief Justice Warren changed that practice in 1965, and now opinions can be announced any day that the court is sitting. Under our current practice, the court rarely announces opinions on Mondays, if it is also hearing arguments on that day. Justice Jackson, as a former Solicitor General, would probably be most interested in the changes in how the court currently conducts oral argument. The Solicitor General is, of course, the federal government's lawyer in the Supreme Court and presents the government's arguments there. Jackson once described his tenure as Solicitor General as the happiest period of his public life. In Jackson's day, the court typically allowed 2 hours for argument, 1 hour for each side. That changed in 1970, when Chief Justice Burger reduced the time to 30 minutes per side. Now, that change has dramatically affected the style of the arguments. Counsel can no longer use their time to engage in a relatively leisurely discourse with the court. The justices are anxious to reach the heart of the dispute quickly, and counsel must be prepared for aggressive questioning from the bench. I believe that Justice Jackson would have approved of that change. He spoke to the California State Association of the Bar while an associate justice on the Supreme Court. His talk is one of those rare 60-year-old speeches that remains completely relevant and indeed is very pertinent to today's Supreme Court. He correctly noted that the justices do indeed rely heavily on oral presentation, and he urged his clients to choose their lawyer based on skill rather than prominence. He cautioned the lawyers against wasting their time flattering justices. He noted that we justices think well enough of ourselves already. Now, I will have to leave it to others to decide if that's changed since Justice Jackson's time. Jackson urged the advocate to maintain focus on key arguments, and he pointed out that questions should be welcomed. As he put it, it is clear proof that the inquiring justice is not asleep. Jackson recognized that the purpose of the argument is always and only to assist a court in resolving a legal dispute. He saw oral advocacy as a high art and knew from his own experience that a skilled lawyer must have a rounded life and balanced judgment to draw inspiration from reason and practical experience. Justice Jackson was a wonderful advocate in his day, and I believe he would be no less so in today's changed environment. Now, when the courtroom arguments are completed, it is time for the justices to take a vote on the case, and we retire to the justices' conference room, the same conference room where Justice Jackson met with his colleagues to discuss Brown versus Board of Education and the other momentous decisions of his era. Now, it was, of course, not true in Jackson's day, but today he would see a large portrait of himself, one of only four portraits in the room, hanging on the wall, supervising the work of today's court. Now, when I look at that portrait, I often remember a story that Jackson told, which aptly describes the proper role of a lawyer and a judge. The story is a parable of three stonemasons who were working together on a structure. Each one was asked in turn what he was doing. The first said, without looking up, "I'm earning a living." The second said, pointing to the wall, "I'm shaping this stone to the pattern." But the third lifted his eyes skyward and said, "I am building a cathedral." Now, for some lawyers and perhaps for some judges, the law is merely a way of earning a wage. And others cannot see beyond shaping a pattern according to precedent. But some inspired lawyers and judges, like Justice Jackson, have understood that they are participating in a loftier enterprise. The Jackson Center is an enduring monument to that ideal. Members of the bench and bar must aim their efforts at working together to build a cathedral, what we call the rule of law. It is an endeavor in which we should take great pride. I congratulate the Jackson Center on 10 sterling years supporting that endeavor. Thank you very much.
That is Chief Justice John Roberts in a speech to the Jackson Center, the Robert H. Jackson Center in Jamestown, New York. This is the 10th anniversary of the formal dedication of this facility, and more ceremony coming up in just a moment. There is a bust of Robert Jackson that is going to be unveiled in just a few minutes. And also, Congressman Higgins will be making a formal announcement as well. Let's go back to the podium.
Jackson Center, and I will be joined for the next part of your program by the granddaughter of Justice Jackson, the Honorable Melissa Jackson, by the grandson of Justice Jackson, Thomas Loftus, and by the chairman of the Board of Directors of the Robert H. Jackson Center, David Crane. Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, thank you. You may have observed, driving into the Jackson Center this morning, a wonderful statue of Robert H. Jackson along Main Street in front of the Samuel Love Elementary School. This statue, of course, greets all visitors as they come in to Jamestown. This statue was sculpted by Dexter Benedict, who has joined us here today in the audience, and dedicated in 1996 by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. When we arranged and we knew that you were coming to the Jackson Center, the idea was conceived for the Jackson Center, funded by the family of Robert H. Jackson Center, to present to you to the Supreme Court, through you, a bust of Robert H. Jackson. Fortunately, a little research, we found that Dexter Benedict still had the mold of that statue in his possession, and that he was very willing and honored to be able to create a bust for us to present here this morning. And so, Mr. Chief Justice, if you would please approach the bust. So, on behalf of the Jackson Center and the family of Robert H. Jackson, we present through you to the Supreme Court a bust of Robert H. Jackson.
And a large bronze bust being unveiled now, to the delight of the crowd gathered on the front lawn of the Robert H. Jackson Center. Chief Justice joining family members in unveiling that bust here this morning.
It will occupy a place of great prominence at the court, just as his portrait does. So thank you all very much.
And again, Chief Justice John Roberts wrapping up his comments here this morning at the Robert H. Jackson Center in Jamestown. Let's go back to the podium and our Master of Ceremonies.
As we draw closure to this incredible day where we've been blessed and honored by the presence of the Chief Justice of the United States, I want to pause and thank all of those who really made this day special, and especially all of the students who are here, almost 2,000 of them who've come to learn about the judiciary from the Chief Justice of the United States, and they've prepared for this specific day, and to all of the volunteers, docents, etc. This has been a magical moment for Chautauqua County, a magical moment for Western New York, certainly a magical moment for the Robert H. Jackson Center. And I want to just thank you so much for honoring us with your presence, Mr. Chief Justice. With that, we stand adjourned.
And that is the final part of this ceremony at the Robert H. Jackson Center in Jamestown this morning. You are listening to live coverage on 88.7 FM WBFO. You heard the Chief Justice say as he began his opening remarks that it is great to be back home. And indeed, that is the feeling here, that this is a homecoming of sorts for the Chief Justice. He was born in Buffalo back in 1955. He lived in the area until about the fourth grade. His father worked for a short time at Bethlehem Steel, and so he does have some Western New York roots, and roots that were on display here today as he talked about the legacy of the Jackson Center, the legacy of former Chief Justice Robert Jackson, for which this center has been named. So it is indeed a rare occasion to have a Chief Justice in town. And lots of folks turned out to take part and to witness this event. Number of dignitaries as well, including Erie County Executive Mark Polenkars, who made the trip down to Chautauqua County. Mark, what did you think? This is a unique and special time to be able to see a Chief Justice in person.
Certainly it's a rare occasion, something that, Chief Justice Rehnquist was here 10 years ago. If you look back through the ages, it rarely happens in Western New York. Truthfully, it rarely happens in the country where a Chief Justice will come and give words of wisdom. As an attorney myself, still registered, though not really practicing because I have a full-time job, I wanted to hear what he'd say. I certainly knew he wasn't going to talk about the issues because they're not allowed to talk about the issues. But what I took from this is his sort of call to members of the bench and bar, attorneys and judges, to work together to create that cathedral, which is the rule of law. Too often we hear about individuals and what they believe the rule of law to be, but I think what he called upon are the attorneys that represent the people before the court, as well as the judges, to do what's right in the long-term interests of the country, not just think about today. He talked about the parable of the stonecutters and how some think about just the day, but how we need to think about the long-term interest in building the cathedral, which is the rule of law of our United States of America. And I'm very pleased to have been here today.
And he constantly pointed back to Chief Justice Jackson, for which this center is named, and not only the role that he played on the court, but perhaps, the message that he may send. He talked a lot about if Chief Justice Jackson could go back to the court today, a lot of things would surprise him, but really the cornerstone of the court hasn't changed.
Correct. There may be tremendous changes to the Supreme Court building itself. I was there just recently. and you could see the amount of work that's being done, as Chief Justice Roberts noted. But Chief Justice Roberts, if he had Justice Jackson on the bench today, I think Justice Jackson might not necessarily understand what was going around in the court with the computers and everything today, but when it got down to sitting at the bench and rendering a decision on behalf of the people of the United States, he'd know exactly what to do. And that's why he is one of the great statesmen that we have here in Western New York, and why we honor not only Justice Jackson at the Jackson Center here, but his name will adorn the new courthouse in downtown Buffalo.
Indeed, something that we can all be very proud of. Mark Poloncarz, thanks so much for your time. Erie County Executive Mark Poloncarz, among the dignitaries on hand here today. Now, we also have a number of students from across Western New York here. 24 different school districts sent students here today, and we have a couple of them joining us. Hi, your name?
Hannah Samuelson.
And your school district?
Jamestown High School. Well, Jamestown Public Schools.
And what did you think today of the address from Chief Justice Roberts?
I think me and my friend Courtney Young agree that it was really inspiring. Just like, he's got so much power. That's so cool to me that he came and took time to come and help us with the anniversary.
Of the Jackson Center. Chief Justice Jackson, do you learn a lot about Chief Justice Jackson since he is a fellow Chautauqua County resident?
Yes, we do in school, especially last year in U.S. history. And we've also gotten to sing inside the Jackson Center many times for madrigals, and it's a elite singing group of the Jamestown High School. And it's so awesome. I'm very grateful that we got invited to come sing for everybody here, and it just something that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life.
All right, your friend here is Courtney. Courtney, your name again?
Courtney Young.
And you're from Jamestown?
Yes.
What did you think?
It's amazing to me that this man who, you know, he does so much, that he came to our little town and he spoke for us, and he's a role model to me because someday I would love to be a district attorney. So I don't know, this is all very interesting to me, and I'm grateful as well that we got to represent our school. So,
and watch out for her, because
she's on her way, huh? Well, what about the message that he sent then today, the role of the court, the work of people like Justice Jackson in the past? What will you take from this?
It makes me proud to know that we've got such amazing people in charge.
Yes.
So it's reassuring.
Ladies, thank you very much for being here. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
And just two of the students that are here today, along with many, many others, who have been invited to the Jackson Center to hear Chief Justice John Roberts. As we said, a very rare occasion to have a Chief Justice in town and to come to a community like this and to spend some time, quality time, as Chief Justice Roberts did. He arrived yesterday. He spent some time at the Chautauqua Institution last night, meeting with, again, local dignitaries. He also, early arrival here at the Jackson Center this morning, took a tour of the facility, met with board members and other dignitaries. Those dignitaries include a number of judges. We heard from Judge Richard Arcara earlier this morning. He's in attendance here today. He will be joining Chief Justice Roberts at a luncheon inside the Jackson Center in just a few minutes. That is closed off to the public. This event here is tightly secured. Security was extremely tight in and around the Jackson Center. Traffic was blocked, and security was visibly in place. The Chief Justice is not making himself available for any interviews or questions or anything like that. But indeed, this has been a special event for this community. The weather, very nice today. It's an outdoor event, as you can imagine. There was some concern about whether the weather will hold. Well, it was ideal weather for this event, with bright sunshine here at the Jackson Center, with about, I would say, easily 2,000 people gathered on the front lawn here, dignitaries up close, sitting in chairs, and many of the students just gathered on the lawn and the streets in front of the Jackson Center, listening to the Chief Justice this morning. So it's been a great occasion for the community, a great occasion for the Jackson Center. You heard Chief Justice Roberts talk a lot about the legacy of Justice Robert Jackson, for which this facility is named. He talked about Jackson's role on the court and his service as chief counsel for the Nuremberg trials, And as you heard, he wondered aloud what it would be like if Justice Jackson could visit the Supreme Court today. And while he may notice many things have changed over the years to the building itself and so forth, the role of the court is something that has not changed. That'll conclude our live coverage from the Jackson Center in Jamestown. For our chief engineer on site here, John Horton, our engineer, Jerry Urban, back at the studio, I'm Jim Ranney. Thanks for listening, and this has been live coverage on 88.7 FM WBFO in Buffalo.